Fish number 22724, Rosemary Slater, reels 5 and 6. Separated by pause and track marker, left channel informant mic only, right channel interviewers mic only.
Rosemary Slater, reel 5.
When, to go back to my husband, after his time in Changi, when the Jap surrender came, they were still in camp, because not knowing quite what was going to happen. The two people who turned up looking for him were his two brother-in-laws. One was the naval captain, Michael Goodenough, who had come out on Mountbatten's staff, and he was the one who had survived the sinking of the Prince of Wales. The other brother-in-law was in the Colonial Police Service and came to Singapore, was posted to Singapore as Commissioner of Police Singapore, and again with Mountbatten as part of his group to get things going again in Singapore.
What was his name?
Robert Fulger. F-O-U-L-G-E-R. He had married Jack's sister out in the Gold Coast, where Jack's father had been governor. He'd been governor of Sierra Leone and Ghana, which is Ghana now, which was the Gold Coast. And then he'd gone as governor to Jamaica. But he had contracted Blackwater fever, and so I think he only had about 2 years in Jamaica, which was very sad, and was posted back to England. He couldn't cope any longer for a man. But, and it was while he was there that the Prince of Wales came out on the same ship as Michael Goodenough, and that's when he met Nancy, of course, who was with her parents at Government House in Jamaica. It's extraordinary, sort of how the world goes round in circles. That was quite interesting. Because Michael saw a lot of the Mountbattens. He was very much one of the blue-eyed boys. And even after the war, he was in the Admiralty in London. He was on Mountbatten's staff. And sadly, it was soon after he became Admiral, he died playing squash with his son. Quite young. In fact, he was the youngest admiral. That was rather, you know, shattering for Nancy. She was left with the two boys and a girl to bring up. But the Mountbattens were very, very good to her, and she used to go and stay with them at Broadlands and things. And so that was a contact when Lady Mountbatten came out to Brunei, to see. In 58, Jack came home after Malayanization. I don't think he knew quite what to do. It was a very different... I think also he wasn't feeling 100%. He was offered the job of Cyprus as Commissioner of Police, but they were going through troubles, and I think Jack felt he'd had enough of the troubles, the communist problems, and didn't want to go into another war zone, as you might say. So we had very quiet... had a lovely village, very quiet time, and he helped a friend who was doing, I can't remember, something. Eventually, the colonial office got in touch on two or three occasions, and eventually, it was after the uprising in Brunei, with the insurgents again, you see, with Indonesia so near, asked Jack if he'd go out to Brunei and start the police game again. We went out in a 3-year contract. So that must be, I think Jack went down 62, if I remember rightly the date. And I followed a bit later. Sadly, things were pretty bad there, and two lots of friends were killed in helicopter crashes, really, while Jack was there, which was a bit shattering. There were sons of great friends, you know, they were young things. But we quite enjoyed Brunei. It was the old Sultan who who was delightful. And things were very, very simple in those days. One went up to the Astana, and of course, naturally, we were very much segregated, and I would go to the women's quarters and sit down and chat madly to a wife, one, two, and three, probably, and all the other women, which was great fun. And Jack would go off, and of course, he was a fluent speaker in Malay, and I had taken lessons to brush up my Malay while we were there. And we got on very well with the old boy. He was a darling. The children were just small, and the present Brunei Sultan, because he was just a little boy. And, of course, one always had to go to the airport to meet them and see them off, as you can imagine. And these obstreperous little boys used to go off in the plane. And of course, there were no private planes in those days. They just went in the ordinary Fokker Friendship planes, I think they were called. And eventually, our armour, we had awful trouble getting staff because Brunei was a very wealthy state. So we had to write to Hong Kong to get an armour to come down and look after it, because the Malay women would not stay and wouldn't work, funnily enough. They didn't need to. They all got wonderful loans. Do you see, there was so much oil. Brunei being very clever, wouldn't go into Malaysia and stayed independent. So they kept their money, as you might say, and their oil. And so there was a certain amount of money around, though, funnily enough, the Sultan was not ostentatious like the present ones. They built a house called the Astana Edinburgh for the Duke of Edinburgh's visit. And this house was finished in time. And I knew a very nice woman, Mrs. Lloyd Dalby, who was rather sort of running things for that side of it, for the Sultan and the household. And she asked me to help her. So I had to go and get china and help get all the linen and everything. And I suppose I did flowers and things too. And that was the other thing. The flowers and the table for the banquets and things were enormous baskets of orchids, because that's all there was. So I used to arrange all these orchids down there. And then, of course, we weren't allowed any wine or anything. And so between the orchids were little bottles of orange pop, which rather spoiled the effect, as you can imagine. Anyway, I think that the Duke of Edinburgh was in great form, and he got this wonderful sense of humour. And he was absolutely delightful, made everybody laugh and feel very much at ease, which was lovely. Enjoyed meeting him, and of course, you know, the High Commissioner had lunches and parties and things, so one sort of caught quite a bit off him, because we were such a small unit, as you say, British people. And interesting people came out. I tried to think, Fred Mully, and who's the nice man with the eyebrows? Dennis Healy. I remember them coming out. And Dennis Healy's wife was delightful. And we had a sort of Radio Brunei going at that time. And I don't think I did it, but somebody else did interviewed her, and she came over very well. And when my daughter came out on holiday, she and another young chap did Radio Brunei with request numbers. And so there were a whole group of sort of Malays and Chinese and everything, and they all used to come on Jan's program, which was great fun. But no, we enjoyed our time there again. You got to know everybody terribly well. Yes, there was very much the oil, as you can imagine, at Panaga was the oil. And there was a very nice club there run by the Shell Company, which we were allowed to use, and a swimming pool and a golf course. And, I mean, a lot of the senior Malay people in the government played golf, and Jack used to play golf there. So it was a very nice feeling. And, again, the little yacht club in Brunei, again, was very nice. Everybody joined, everybody belonged to it. There was no trouble in those days over drink in the clubs. We were allowed any amount. They all had drinks, which now, of course, you're not. Now the Shell Company Club is not allowed to keep drink. The little yacht club's no longer allowed to keep drink, and which we thought, which I still think is extraordinary, because when you think of the present way the Sultan lives in London and his family, and when I think how strict the old boy was, but you know, it was a very sensible old Sultan. He never minded that. And I mean, when I did the Istana, I had to see that, you know, Duke of Edinburgh's whisky was there and all the rest of it. Well, now I believe there's, you know, there's none of that, which I find very odd. And as I say, in those days, also, then I, interesting, I started up, that's how I met Lady Mountbatten, because a very nice Red Cross girl came out from London. Well, she wasn't a girl, she was a nice elderly woman, shall I say. And chatting to her, and she said, Rosemary, she said, I've been around the hospital, and it seems awfully sad. They seem to sit and do nothing. Is there anything you think you could do? So I've always been fairly practical. So I said, well, supposing that, especially with the children, I said, what about if I get, you know, make out sort of scrapbooks and get, everybody can give me Christmas cards and magazines. And so I managed to get lots of fairly blunt scissors, but they could cut them out, crayon books and crayons. And the Brunei Rotary Club were wonderful and supplied them a lot of the money. And I was able to get the evening papers, every day a paper, which I took round to the men, which I loved. And then they wanted to do basket work, so I dashed to Singapore, stayed at Brunei House while I got all the equipment and everything else, and had a few lessons in basket weaving. Very, very few, very badly done. But when I got back to Brunei and took around, the men, of course, were wonderful. They just fell on and had no trouble in. So then we were making waste paper baskets and trays, and so we were able to sell that, and so that money was ploughed back. And, of course, the other thing which they adored was jigsaws. So I had big boards made so they could put them under their beds in the hospital, you know, complete with their jigsaws, and change them around all the time. And I think they made quite a difference. And I had a very nice letter when I left from the Sultan thanking me for all that. And Jack was made a datto, which is well, in Malaya it's the same. It's, I suppose it's like a knighthood conferred on him. So I became a dateen. Very grand.
D-A-T-I-N. D-A-T-I-N.
And Jack was a datto.
D-A-T-O.
So
so you were a lady.
Yes. So
that must have been a very interesting time in Brunei.
Very interesting time, yes. And quite a lot happening. And very nice army people, naturally.
What's the affluence going throughout their society,
yes,
at that time?
Very much. Because all the fishermen were able to get loans, very cheap loans for outboard motors and buildings and everything. And by the time Jack left, we had great big new police station being made, new barracks. We had a lovely old house just along, not very far from where the High Commissioner's house was. But sadly, it had a very peculiar atmosphere, there's no doubt about it. And it was used by the Japs, the Kempetai. And whether that left something there, I don't know. But I never was at my ease in that house, though it was a lovely house. Sad. But we used to have enormous, the first time I nearly died of shock, we had some iguanas, which must have been a good 6 foot or more. They lived at the back, up in the sort of very scrubby jungle. And then used to come down in the evening on their way to the river, do you see? But one got used to them. They were most inoffensive. They didn't want to know you, so we just let them wander around.
Did you meet Lady Mountbatten?
Yes, I did. Yes, and I thought she was charming. And I was very lucky because I took her around the hospital, being the Red Cross and having done quite a bit of work there. She was interested to know what had been done. So we went round together, and then I said, would you like to come back and have lunch with us and see, you know, the house and things? So she said, yes, that'd be lovely, because she said, though she was staying at the High Commissioner's, she said, it's quite nice to see how everybody else is living. So she came back and was very charming. And then she went back to the High Commissioner that night. The next morning, she flew up to Jesselton and stayed there. I think that was probably the only place for her to stay, because Jesselton was very small in those days, and she stayed with a WVS girl. I had met the girl because she'd been down on leave to Brunei, and she'd taken a dust lady my bag, and if she wanted tea in the morning, she said, yes, that would be lovely. And she'd gone in with her tea and found she had died in her sleep. I think it must have been very peaceful because there'd been no sound or anything. So you can imagine that was quite a shock to us all. Jack had to fly up and help with arrangements because of the body would have to be flown back. And you can imagine all that happening. Very sad, because she was wonderful. She went all over. And though I'd seen her, but I'd never talked to her in Malaya, because she'd come round, because we ran SAFA units, you know, for children and families and police families, and she'd come round to see how they were working, because that had been started by Lady Templar. She was a great one for that.
What were these units?
SAFA units.
SAFA,
yes. Soldier Sailors Airmen's Families Association. And that was Lady Templar started those, as you probably know. And so she was first thinking we should start WVS. And not WVS, I don't mean that, sorry. Women's Institutes. Must get that right. And also these clinics, you see. So we had a SAFA sister sent to us, and out at the back of our compound in Kelantan, we had these sort of empty, must have been barracks at some site. Anyway, we had those whitewashed, and we set up our clinics there for all the babies and mothers and things to come, and a very nice sister. And we had a jeep with our Red Cross on it, and we used to travel the whole of Kelantan. Now, that was at the time very much when the communists were still there. I will say that for the communists, that on the whole, they did not attack European women or civilians in that capacity. And we may even, without realizing, having given out medicines in some of the villages, because it was very difficult to differentiate. And though we were really supposed to be doing only police stations, you could imagine there were others around which we gave medicine to. And we used to go up rivers on the border with Thailand in an outboard motor. And I often took Jan with me, my little daughter, who was only two. We went all over. In fact, I went to every police station in Kelantan with my SAFA sister. And then we used to have the most terrifying meetings in Kuala Lumpur with Lady Stockwell, Lady Templar, and this enormous table with all the CPO wives from roundabout and army wives. And then you would ask how things were going in your area. I was a young 26, absolutely terrified, as you can imagine. But I must say, Lady Stockwell was a darling. I used to stay with her often when I went down. But Lady Templar, of course, was charming. And so was the old General Templar. He came to Kelantan and stayed with us once when the local British advisor was away. He couldn't have been nicer, and great fun.
Am I right in thinking there was a system of putting the local people, the Malays, in villages, in protected villages?
Particularly the Chinese. It wasn't the Malays, it was the Chinese that were brought in, because they were the ones who naturally had more affinity with the communists. And so that was one of the big things. I didn't see very much of it because Kelantan being very much a Malay state, we didn't have much of that. But the communists were very much in touch across the border with Thailand. So when things were getting hot in Malaya, they would go across the border. And of course the Thais naturally weren't really too worried one way or the other. So Ping Cheng, he used to go backwards and forwards with his lot. So there was quite a bit of activity, army activity, chasing up the areas. And, helicopters to come and pick Jack up to go into some of these camps in the jungle, which we had British other ranks, police ranks, police inspectors running. And I can't remember what force they were called, those. But anyway, they were in deep jungle. And Jack used to get flown in to see how things were going, and they liaised with army units, as you can imagine, quite a bit.
There were a lot of National Service people, I think, weren't
there? Yes, there were, very much at that time, which must have been quite difficult for them, coming straight out from England, wasn't it? But I didn't meet very many of them.
It's interesting you saying about setting up women's institutes.
Yes,
did this work? You know, was it a good system?
Well, it was a good system to a degree that it was mostly at rather a high-powered level, you see, because the Sultan's wives were all for it. And what I call our Mentre Bazaar, which was our prime minister, as you might say, local prime minister there, and all the other sort of high-ups in Malays. And it was their wives and things, and then the Chinese, the wealthy Chinese wives. So it wasn't really quite what I would have called WI England style, but it used to be quite hilarious. I mean, there were about 20 of us used to probably meet in houses, and then we would all take along something we'd cooked, you see, and then we explained how it was done. And terrible cushions and yellow satin with gold thread and things, and I was quite good at patchwork, so that was my thing. So taught them all how to do patchwork and ridiculous things like that. But probably, you see, it wasn't really hitting the right. The idea was all right, but you see, it couldn't really go into a camp on and start it, really. There was very little of that. I think some of the district officers' wives probably did a bit. But I don't think they found it very easy. The Malays are very good at sewing, and basket work, and cooking and things. There wasn't really an awful lot we could teach them. But really for, I presume, sort of ideas and things, which was great fun. Sultan's wife were a most amusing crowd. As I say, they were very enthusiastic and about this WI idea. In many ways it probably was, but there wasn't really much we could teach the Malays. I mean, they were wonderful cooks, they did wonderful curries, they did wonderful chutneys and embroidery. The houses were full of lovely sort of embroidery, as you can imagine, all slightly bright and cheerful. And there were gardens, they all had bits of vegetable gardens and things. But I think it was probably just the very fact that you all met and chatted and things, which was probably the great thing. Though I will say that after the war, there was never really the feeling of them and us. It was very much, much more open. You know, all the clubs and things we invited, you didn't get the feeling that you... I think Africa must have been much more... I would have hated that. I had a great friend who was a school teacher in Penang, and she had been got out of Penang and had gone to Africa. And when she was in South Africa, must have been either Cape Town or Durban, she'd heard that there was a Malay contingent of people there and had gone to see them. And everybody was absolutely horrified. You see, by the way, to us in Penang, I mean, we had our Malay officers, you know, came and went. There was not the feeling. And, I mean, in Singapore pre-war, All right, probably in the clubs I didn't see very many locals, but you see, we rode on trolley buses and buses and trishaws, and there wasn't quite the same feeling that there must have been in Africa. And I've always blessed Malaya for that, because there was no real apartheid as there was. And probably, I don't think it was as stringent as it was even in India. It was a much gentler, much more open country, because, you see, a lot of the districts had Malay district offices. And also, you see, you had a sultan in your state. So that there was quite a lot of hierarchy there, with the different senior Malay officers attached to our secretariat and all that. So it was much more integrated, shall I say, of the Malays. And one of the great things about Malaya was that we were very strict about having Malaya for Malays. And though we had a certain amount of what they called the Chinese inspectorate, which looked after I suppose, the mines, because there were a lot of Chinese-owned mines, but trying to keep a balance so that they would not swamp the Malay country, as you might say, and take over, because naturally they were the cleverer ones. Malays are a gentle, charming people, but they're not, haven't got the brains that the Chinese or the Indian have. All the shops, like so many places in Africa, were all run by Indians and things. But there was never a funny feeling about it. You know, I don't remember any troubles there. That
yes, I was, you know, going back to Lady Mountbatten and her death. That must have been very difficult for your husband, wasn't it, in his position? Was there any sort of concern about it, that it, you know, there might have been suspicions?
No, none at all, none at all. And though Jack had flown up, it wasn't in, really in his jurisdiction, Sabah. It was a separate state, but it was a very much smaller state, and Jack had really just gone up to help, you know, because naturally had to contact Singapore and everybody, you know, about the movement of the body and everything. So that to see that that was all cleared and that there was no problems. It was just, you know, her heart gave out.
So. She wasn't very old, was she?
No, she wasn't. I can't think what age she might be.
What was she like as a person? Was she, you know, you...
Very definite. Very definite to talk to. Nice, but you couldn't take any liberties, as you might say, the stupid word, but you know what I mean. Because after all, she was who she was, and been all over the world, and after all, she'd been the viceroy's wife. But she was interested in everything, which I found marvelous, and could talk about anything. But nevertheless, you had terrific respect for her. You know.
I think she'd also visited the Wasbys during the war.
Yes,
did she know you were a Wasby?
I don't know if it came up or not at that time. I didn't know she'd visited the Wasbys, had she? Wonder where. Must have been Rangoon, I suppose. Because it wouldn't have... Well, unless she came to Calcutta. Because I forget what years he was there, but you see, he was... They weren't there very long. Did they? Because partition was 47, and I don't think they were there much longer than a year, were they, before it happened? If I remember, get my dates right, I must look up my books on that. But partition was quite something.
Yes, did you? Were you involved with that at all?
Not at all.
Any of the violence
in
India?
No, because I'd gone by then. I think some of the Wasbys saw it. Of course, had gone back to families in India, must have seen it. And I met a man the other day whose family had quite the trouble getting out of India. They were up north, and they were in one of these trains, which he said was very hairy. He had two young children. But eventually they made Bombay and were able to get on a ship. But
did you have, you know, during your time in India, as you were going over to Shillong, was there any sort of signs then of the trouble, or, did you have to take special care?
No, not at all. Not at all. I don't ever remember any problems. And, I mean, even in stations and things, at night, I can't remember anything. As I say, it wasn't really to Burma that sometimes up in Kalor we did have escorts with us, the bad, sort of bad bits. But otherwise, I don't ever remember in India at all. Sadly, I never got up to Simla or anywhere. They said. My daughter got to know this man called Peter Hopker very well, who's written these very interesting books on the Great Game and two others, which are well known, anybody in Afghanistan, North India. And Peter was going out to India, so he asked Jan if she'd come out, and he knew she sketched very well. And so she did the illustrations for his little book called Kim.